everyone, and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat. And my wonderful guest today is Crystal McGilvery. She is the founder of Mind Over Money. Crystal, welcome to Wisdom Chat.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Yeah,
I'm excited
again.
To be here.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you, and lovely to see you again as well. We've had a bit of a chat, and we're talking about some of the things that we might sort of chat about on the podcast. But before we get into that, again, just sort of remind our listeners, Mind Over Money, what is it? What does it do?
So Mind Over Money is a training and educational business. So we deliver group training mainly, whether it's to business owners or just regular people like me and you around personal finance. And the aim is to reduce financial shame, avoidance, and get people to feel more confident about their money. And also there's a piece around interactions around money. So when we have those conversations, whether it's with financial institutions or just our family, making that less taboo.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. Because we know that money is one of those, it's highly emotive. It's one of those subjects that we often come across that people find hard to talk about. Some people will shout it from the rooftops, but then I often wonder what the motive is behind that. And then some people just stay rather sort of quiet about it. So Crystal, in terms of the work that you do, and we're talking about some of the stigma around money or the way that people relate to money. Now, you've got an assessment tool. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, and how did that come about? What is it that you're wanting to help people with?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been supporting people one-on-one as well. So alongside the group work that I do, whether it's with corporates or programs that are supporting new founders, I work with people on a one-on-one basis, and that allows me to really get close up front to the problem and where people struggle. And that's allowed me, along with all the other research that we know is so amazing around, you know, not being able to deal with financial shocks, for example, and just really understanding those key points that contribute to us having financial stress and worry and problems. So it's pulling those main areas to the forefront and asking a few questions to get them to really look at and, you know, get a magnifying glass on those areas and say, ah, okay, so that's what I should be thinking about in that area. I haven't considered that before. I think, you know, a lot of people aren't even aware of things like your credit profile and how many different things that can affect, including, like, you know, you getting a job. So it's just getting people to really think through those different areas and give them some pointers to get started.
Yeah, I suppose there's a lot really riding on how people relate to money, isn't there? You know, you mentioned lots of different areas that, you know, people impact and are impacted by. But one of the things that I do know you've sort of referred to, and I refer to too, is that how people relate to money, mm-hmm. and how that sort of the way that they relate to money sort of drives their mindset and behavior. What sort of things have you come across that has really, well, I'm just thinking, what was the most bizarre thing that you came across when you're working with people that you'd not come across before, perhaps?
Let's think. The most bizarre. You put me on the spot. Let's think back. Okay, I've got one idea in mind. Is that the most bizarre? Mm-hmm. I guess how she described it sounded bizarre at the time, so I don't know if this would be bizarre enough for you. There was one lady who... We know about impulse spending. We know about struggling to save. Yeah. And she took some time to really think through what was going on there. And she related her inability to keep money in her bank to her mother, who was the same. So the only time her mother had money was when it was time to buy a new washing machine. So she would save her money to buy the washing machine and then spend it straight away. So her bank account was always at, you know, zero or really low. Yeah. So this particular person, the same thing. So if she got a bonus at work or got a refund from somewhere, she'd be really compelled to spend it straight away. And then when she just kind of thought back, she was like, oh, it's because I'm not used to money being in the account, which is such an interesting connection.
Yeah. Yeah, it is bizarre. I mean, one of the things that I come across on a regular basis, and I think you've alluded to this in the past as well, is how people say, oh, I'm bad with money,
yeah,
or I'm not good with numbers.
Yeah.
That seems to be a very common thing. But somebody to say out of the blue, do you know, I'm not used to having money in my bank account.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose people are thinking, yeah, well, that would be the problem then, wouldn't it? You know, if you've not got money in your bank account, then maybe we jump to a conclusion, you're not good with money.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I just wonder whether, as a society, we're very quick to judge people without really knowing what's going on behind the scenes. So you alluded to the fact that she was acting just like a mother. So there's learned behaviour there, isn't there? There's certainly an observation of how a mum sort of handled her finances, and she's replicating that same kind of behaviour, maybe the mindset. So what sort of happened from that? How did you sort of help this lady?
Yeah, I think with most of these cases, it's what I think is the biggest mover, if I call it that, that really kind of shakes somebody out of this routine, the habit they've been in, the cycle they've been in, is really exposing that. And that's why I mentioned the magnifying glass.
Yeah.
Because before that conversation, she'd never thought about it in that way before.
Mm.
So she was really quite shocked herself. And it then, and this is where I get really excited, because once she was able to look at it in that way, she then became empowered to realize that actually there's nothing wrong with her. It's
Yeah.
actually instead just an association, an assumption, a habit that she's picked up from, like you said, learned behavior. So that then gave her the confidence to say, okay, well, I don't have to do that. So
yeah.
Let me, we work through trying something else instead. And, you know how it goes. You start small, you know, okay, let's commit to building up £20 in your saving this month, or whatever it was. So then she's gone on a journey, and now she has savings, which is just really amazing.
Yeah.
But that first piece of being able to give how you are making financial decisions a narrative, and realizing that, like you just said, I'm just bad at maths, and I'm just bad at finances, it gets rid of that belief.
It's interesting. When I've looked at people who respond with I'm bad at maths, or bad with money, or no good with numbers, I've really wanted to drill down and find out, where does that actually come from? Mm-hmm. And very often it will be, say, for example, a school where they just didn't enjoy algebra or trigonometry. And oftentimes we get so hung up on these things. I know the Prime Minister's talked about, you know, why students need to stay in education until at least 18 and learn maths till 18. And I'm thinking, but what are you expecting them to learn? Because if it's more algebra and trigonometry and quadratic equations and Pythagoras' theorem and things like that, how many people are actually using those things in everyday life? On a personal level, I personally think that we ought to be teaching people the things that they need for everyday life. And these other things are kind of peripheral and may well be used in certain occupations, but they're certainly not used in every occupation.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's like teaching calculus and hoping that somebody's credit score improves. There's no association whatsoever. There's no connection. I remember I actually did a little reel about that exact point, and it was quite popular. Because I think he's missed the mark there. And a lot of us, you know, agree that actually that's not what people need to learn. They need to learn about financial education, literacy, skills, knowledge. That's the area that we need more attention.
We're needing to really improve people's financial capabilities. So,
exactly.
You know, you can educate somebody till the cows come home, but unless they understand how to apply that in their own circumstances, it won't necessarily mean a lot. But one thing I I was interested in, and you kind of, in some of your posts and articles and things, you talk about relationship with money,
mm-hmm.
and types or personalities. What kind of things have you come across which you know you've seen as being different from one person to another in terms of how they relate to money and how they use it? What have you sort of discovered as being like drivers that sit behind it and so on?
I mean, you've got, for example, someone who's a big hoarder. And, you know, this question is always so interesting because I think people assume that if we think about upbringing and experience, that a certain type of experience or upbringing is going to totally directly correlate to how the person is today. But that's not the case. You know, if I think of one client I had, his take home was 250K per year. But still every month he was negative. And that's because in terms of his upbringing and his experience, his parents were so wealthy that money was not a thing in the household. It was, yeah, whatever, very free and frivolous. So he never learned the skills like you're talking about, having the capability to understand, yeah, manage, you know, and deal with those things. So he was very frivolous with his spending. Go on, yeah. I know you want to have a comment.
No. I was just thinking that, you know, how many of us would say, oh, I'd like a salary of 250K.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. The one thing I come across, and I don't know if you come across it as well, but the assumption of many people that somebody who's struggling with their money doesn't mean to say they're bad with money, but it could be, and they're not necessarily in debt. Mm-hmm. So we assume that people who need the money education are the people who are low income or on benefits, are in debt, you know, and they don't understand things. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people around like that, but what we're talking about applies to anybody. And you've just demonstrated that with the story of your client and their income. And the fact is, unless they have that input, that education, and then that the developing of the understanding and the capability to apply it, they could actually repeat the same behaviors that they've seen, whether it's of their parents, guardians, whoever else, without realizing what it is they're doing.
And this makes me want to loop back to the point you made earlier, and I was going to comment then actually, so I'm glad it's come back here. But
yeah,
I am increasingly so talking so much more about financial empathy. And you mentioned it earlier, you know, you have no idea what's going on with somebody else, what's happening behind the scenes, what's going on at home. You know, a lot of cultures send money back to parents or family in other countries. That takes a massive chunk out of their income. Or like this person I just spoke about, we don't know what his thought process is or how he feels, or, you know, somebody who's sad or emotionally not in a good place and how that impacts their spending. We have no idea about that narrative. And I think often, and I think this, and I assume it's the right thought process, but someone who's earning, you know, 300K or whatever, the general public would be like, well, they've got a big salary, so what's that? You know, they don't need the care and attention, they're fine. And totally missing the mark with actually deal with that person in isolation. They, you know, as the real example here, they're still struggling every month. They're still very stressed because, you know, their decisions that they're making
are
causing the day-to-day circumstances to be really hard. I talk a lot about financial empathy because I think it's really missed.
That's really a good point. It just reminded me of a client I was working with who's actually a chartered accountant.
Mm.
And people said to me, why on earth would a chartered accountant, you know, want to come to you and want your services?
Yeah.
And it is for the very reason that you've just described.
Yep.
So it's having that sort of financial empathy to help a person in their particular circumstances deal with the challenges they think they're facing. So in this person's case, they dealt with finances day in, day out. They had a team that they managed that dealt with millions of pounds in terms of the company that they worked for, but then would come home and it was the last thing he wanted to do was to sit down and start managing his family's finances. but he realized that's what he needed to do. He was the one with the skills, but he felt really guilty and really ashamed that he'd not done that.
Mm.
And he just needed somebody to coach him through the process. And I think as well, when people think of finances, it's a little bit like talking about, I don't know, pensions. You talk to a pensions advisor, and I don't know about you, but sometimes I walk away going, I wonder if he was speaking English there. You know, you're thinking, what on earth did he just say? How does that work? And you know, I think of myself as quite a switched on person, but if somebody who is explaining something to me, whether that's pensions or tax or whatever it may be, there's this notion of making it complex, and it doesn't need to be.
I think there is sometimes just disconnect when it comes to financial advisors, and we know that, you know, and I say this from personal experience, speaking to lots of financial advisors, that whole empathy piece and trying to make sure the information they're trying to impart is tailored for that individual where they are. And that's often where the work and energy and effort is required. And if that individual hasn't got those skills, then that's where it can kind of miss the mark. But yeah, for sure. I think it's definitely a thing. Needing to communicate about finance in a way that can be received. And it's not just, hey, this is the numbers, press this button, good to go. there's a human behind that. Like, where are they? Are you connecting with them?
I think some people listening to this will be saying, oh, I wish there wasn't a button I could just press and we were good to go.
Yeah, we want this.
just on that note, though, you have a thing called financial health check.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit about that. And how does that sort of help people?
Yeah, so kind of what I touched on earlier. So again, through my experience and picking up on various different pieces of research, like we've both seen around, you know, the key areas that if these aren't sound, you're really going to struggle financially, you know, having a savings pot or, you know, credit being in a good condition so that when you need to apply to rent a place or get a mortgage, you're ready. So this health check is effectively pulling together all those different elements so that somebody can see, okay, this area needs a bit of attention, right? And then it gives them a bit of guidance as to how they can go forward and start addressing some of those issues that maybe popped up. Because I find that when I work with people, they don't actually realize what those different areas are. And I think giving some kind of structure that they can focus on makes it easier to improve your finances. Whereas when it's just a bit of a cloud of, oh, I need to sort my money, you're a bit lost and not sure how to navigate it.
Yeah. So
it's kind of thinking through in a process.
I come across quite a few people who I very quickly realised they're thinking, I don't know where to start with all this. It's not that they're, you know, they don't have the ability. It's just nobody's really sort of unpacked all the different facets of finances, you know, from, you know, a savings scheme. And how might I go about that? And what would be the best, you know, accounts or best ways of saving and things like this? And so there's this sort of feeling of, I don't really know where to start, therefore I just feel stuck. So to have somebody like yourself come along and say, actually, let's look at your circumstances and see what's right for you, and be able to sort of point them in the right direction. You know, straight away, it's going to give somebody that feeling of that growing confidence. Oh, really? And that's all I have to do. And, you know, and before you know it, they've got their light bulb moments and there's a smile on their face because you know you're making a difference. Yeah, so a person who's growing in confidence because of the input that you've given them around different facets of their finances and how they can just simply do that. I mean, think the thing that really strikes me is there are some things that's, like you said, there's this disconnect from the financial world to the person at the coal face and how do they interpret the information applied to their own circumstances. And for some people, if nobody spent time showing them then it can be quite challenging. I know for me, I very often I'll hear instructions, but actually I learn better by doing it myself.
Yeah.
It's nice to have somebody next to you. So a coach like yourself, who gives that feeling of I'm okay, because Crystal's with me. And so I can check out things, or she'll point me in the right direction. That would give somebody confidence.
Yeah, because I think, like with anything, right, if you're going to embark on learning or improving a specific area of your life, whether it's, yeah, I don't know, fitness, you're going to walk into the gym and be kind of overwhelmed as to where to start. What do I do? How do I, what muscles, you know, you're quite confused. So it's nice to have that structure of what to work through. And yeah, it also can help that person feel more confident in that, I'm going to work through these key areas. Great.
Yeah.
You know, because I often hear, you know, people try to do the work themselves and they're looking online, they're trying to find, and they're like, I'm overwhelmed with where to go and what to start with and what's the best thing for me. So giving them just a bit of guidance as to, all right, think about this in this way to help you get to the right decision that's for you.
I do think for a lot of people, that would be invaluable to them. But it's the initial hurdle they've got to get over in their own thinking, and this whole stigma about money. And for our listeners, I just really want to emphasize the fact that when you're talking to somebody like yourself, Crystal, or for myself, we hold confidentiality very highly.
Yes.
And when we're dealing with people, there's no judgment, none whatsoever. Irrespective of how somebody has managed their money in the mm-hmm. past or where they're at the moment, it's just purely about helping them regain control, peace of mind, and that sense of I'm now moving forward, or I'm moving in the right direction. So.
I think it's really important you say that, and I, you know, with how I show up online and show up in places that people can reach me or learn from me or get, you know, even if it's just signposting to somewhere, I put every effort into making sure that I communicate this topic area with care and kindness and gentleness, because that's what was required for an individual to say, hey, stranger, I'm going to expose my finances to you and trust you and hope that you're not going to laugh at me for fill in the blank. And you know, a lot of people who do have debts who come to me, not everybody does, like you said, those that do always think that their situation is the worst. And I actually quite enjoy when we have a laugh by me saying, actually, I know someone, and you know, it totally gets them to relax a bit, to realize, oh, okay. And it brings a bit of, you know, I think even on my health check, I've got a picture of me laughing, because I'm like, money doesn't have to be stressful and sad. You can have joy. You can talk about it positively. But that's only going to come because somebody feels safe and secure to be able to have those conversations. So, I think it's really important that you said that.
That's great. In terms of your health check, how long does it take a person to go through the health check?
Not long, less than 10 minutes. It's funny because I remember coming across, who was it? Oh, I can't remember. I can see her face. There's a lady, she's American. She's put together, I think there's like 4 or 5 questions on their health check, and it's really very simple, to the point where I wonder how much are you going to get from those 4 or 5 questions. But it's not going into the depth of, okay, have you got savings, or less than 10 minutes. It's not crazy. It's more of, because you know, I have to find a balance between it giving them a useful information, so learning a bit about them to be able to say, hey, this might be helpful, to not being off-putting, because we know that, you know, attention spans are low, so it couldn't have been 50 questions. They'd be like, I'm not doing this.
You're right about that. I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, if somebody finds, you know, dealing with their finances quite challenging, then to say, oh, by the way, I've got this health check and it's going to take you half an hour, and you've got to sit it under exam conditions.
Nobody would do it. No.
No.
I had to strike that nice balance, so that people would be, you know, would want to do it, or, you know, want to carry on to the end. And then get some pointers at the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. I use an assessment tool called Money Habitudes, and that's not so much asking people questions as to giving them a statement and asking them to put it under one of three categories. That's me. That's sometimes me. That's never me. And it's interesting. Out of those, there's the six categories, and there's nine statements for each category. But it does actually create an interesting picture at that point in time as to a person's sort of default position when given circumstances. So I'll give you an example. I had a client who came to me. They were a property lawyer and dealt with some really high-end properties. So you'd assume, well, you're on a huge income, so you shouldn't need to worry about finances. Yet among their friends, given the fact they were the highest earner, often found themselves in debt or didn't have enough to do some of the things that the friends were doing. And they couldn't understand this. And in the conversation, there was a lot of things we pulled out, but one of the things that they commented on, and this is, I think this is quite common, and that is, when I've had a tough day, I go and do some retail therapy.
Of course.
Now, they're telling me about it, but they've never made the connection between that behavior and the fact that they're always in debt or the one with the least amount of available cash at any point in time. Yeah. And so it was an interesting situation. But however, we all use coping mechanisms, don't we? I think less than 50% of the working population have any kind of financial plan, not even a spending budget for the month. And when you think about that, one of the things that I've come across is, because of this notion, I'm bad with numbers, I'm no good with money. And this has come from people who are high earners as well as people who are on a sort of low income level. It's no wonder then that they won't sit down and look at their finances. They just don't feel they've got that confidence and so on. But also how subconsciously they're using coping mechanisms to deal with how they're feeling at the time. I think it was Dave Ramsey from the States who said 80%, around about 80-90% of the decisions we make are emotionally driven. So if we don't understand our emotions or the emotions that we're feeling at any point in time, we're perhaps not appreciating how those emotions are driving our mindsets and driving our behaviours.
It's so funny, because when we think about it, I'm signed up to a bunch of, as you can imagine, behavioral science, behavioral economics newsletters. And I literally just came across one, I think it was, what day are we, Tuesday, a couple of days ago. And it was talking about that. And it, you know, it challenged the 80%, the 90%, but that's beside the point. What I think we forget is our brains are really smart. So our brains, in any decision-making moment, is going to make a decision using heuristics. So basing it on what's the smartest, quickest, shortest, less energy, less time thing we can do right now. And if one of those things that go into that decision tree is, hey, I'm sad, how can I quickly feel good?
Yes.
And that's the focus. So the decision tree that will take you down to, no, save your money. You want to buy a house in 6 months. That's not part of it, because what's most poignant, like what's standing out the most, is I'm not feeling good. And that takes over.
Yeah.
So then you go ahead and you buy the whatever from Oxford Street. And I say this because this was me on a Friday evening after work for a very long time. You go ahead and you do that. But if you're not, and this is where habits are really important, if you're not in the habit of looking at your finances, you're never going to know the impact. So
that's right.
And they're quite detached in that sense, right? Until it becomes, until money management and those habits and those day-to-day activities do get into the forefront of your brain, then they can pipe up in that decision tree process and kind of trip you up and create that friction amongst other habits that you put in place.
Interestingly, that same behavior, that pattern of behavior and the heuristics you talk about, I saw that in investment management because it was interesting when the markets were quite sort of buoyant and everybody was happy and smiley and, you know, investment managers would sit and they would compile their reports and analysis for their clients. But when the money suddenly went, when the market suddenly went volatile, it was a completely different behavioral pattern that you would see. And some would fall into following the crowd, the herding bias. And some would be, you know, looking, they'd have a belief and they'd be looking for that confirmation of their belief, whether their belief was right or not. And, you know, you saw all manners of biases coming into play. And you could clearly see this, whole element of heuristics coming in and wanting the least amount of energy to think and the easy options of the decision making. We'd often say, you know, you sell high and buy low. And that would all go to pot in times in the market. And you think, what are you doing? That is not what you know, and so it was interesting just watching those behaviors. I'm just thinking of what one of those, and it's a part of a market that really came to the forefront. It's been there for a while, but it's really had sort of headline, and that's that buy now, pay later. You know, we've got, what's it? Oh, dear me, it begins with K.
Klarna.
You know, that's the one I hear an awful lot of, but there are others out there. Where, you know, we're driven to, well, they've got, you know, a brand new TV. It's all singing, all dancing. I want one of those. This notion that you're part of that, by doing this, you're going to be part of that crowd. Or I just simply want to have a house like everybody else has a house. So I'm going to furnish it, but I haven't got the money here and now. Buy now, pay later. And that is... I've seen, you know, some really horrendous outcomes as a result of that. And that being presented even to high school students. You know, I have a big concern about it, but I don't know, what have you come across on that? Because you've spoken of it, you sort of wrote a post about it. What are your thoughts on the buy now, pay later market?
I mean, I'll add in there, I was also on ITV Tonight talking about it. And when it was at its peak, they were making some big decisions about it, I went on with the two other people, one a fellow economist and another financial advisor, to talk about it. And we did this cool thing where we watched a video of eye tracking movement to see how people viewed the website, to the use of bright colors, pink, to get their attention, and all of that we looked at. So Two sides, right? One side, you've got people who don't have the financial capability. If we, you know, move away from the language of financial education, they don't have that to help guide them in making those financial decisions at that point. So they are the ones who are susceptible and most likely to get themselves into financial struggles, because these platforms, these apps, are using behavioral science techniques to get somebody to click buy, even though they haven't got the money in their bank account. And, you know, I know that this kind of borrowing was being used heavily during the pandemic because people were struggling financially to buy things like food or takeaway or, you know, things that weren't, it's not like, hey, I've got the money, I'm just using this to get my credit. It was purely for day-to-day living. Yeah. So I think that's where it can be really problematic and people can really quite quickly spiral. But I'm not, and that's where the problem lies. On the other side, it can be a really useful tool if used correctly, a bit like credit cards. If used correctly, if you have the understanding, you know, I have a credit card, of course, and I have the money in my bank account, but I use on the credit card purely for the sake of credit, getting my emails and all the good things that come with it. But when you don't have that knowledge of how to use these systems to your benefit, that's when people can really trip themselves up. And if we think about the nation and where people are financially, that's a larger proportion.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Given certain circumstances that people find themselves in at any point in time, could be the difference between stopping and saying, no, I'm going to walk away and think about it, to, well, I must have it. And what the one of the reasons why I sort of mentioned the emotional side is emotions are quite powerful. And if somebody, like the example I gave, has had a really rough day and they just want to feel good about themselves, they're more susceptible to go down a route and accept something, even though actually it's probably not the best decision for them at that point in time.
Yeah, for sure.
So I said to this this client of mine, I said, okay, I said, when you go and do some retail therapy, when you see something that you think, oh, that's good, that's nice, rather than buy it there and then, why don't you just walk past it and give yourself a week to think about it? Well, they said to me, I couldn't possibly do that. And I said, why not? Well, what if it's not there when I come back? So I then asked the question, well, what difference to your life will that make? And it was only at that point when they stopped, when they started to realize, and now we're looking at the facts rather than the emotion.
Yeah.
Actually, do you know what? It wouldn't make a difference to my life. And it was at that point when you're kind of using that rational, logical thinking process that this person actually identified for themselves that this it wouldn't alter my life. What it might do is put me in a position where, oh, there I go again. I've spent the money. And I can't do the things that I want to do with my friends. So a week later, this particular client rang up and was just so excited on the phone. Now, we are talking about a professional individual who we assume is all calm and collect, you know, but having a breakthrough where they've literally walked past something and they didn't buy it and they just That's want to so tell nice. You about it.
That must have felt so good. That must have felt so good.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, what you're talking about there is emotional regulation.
Yeah.
So it's you've helped them look objectively at the situation and take control of how they might be in that situation. So they've, you know, been able to think about themselves in the future. They know what that environment looks like, and they've been able to, you know, draw up a scenario, bring that from, you know, to today and imagine it, and then give themselves an idea of how they might deal with that when it comes about again, which is the emotional regulation. That's effectively what you taught them in that moment when you're feeling, oh, whatever you're feeling about buying this thing, actually, you can take charge and walk away. And that's a really empowering thing to do. So no wonder why they called you ecstatic. Of course. It's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, it's lovely when you have things like that and you realize then and then this person recognizes for themselves, I've had a breakthrough. And that's so important. And I just think, I mean, I was thinking of sometimes what my wife says to me. She's, you know, I've bought something and she goes, you've been watching the adverts again, haven't you? It's usually technology or something like this. And I'm going, no, I haven't. No. She knows me too well. And but I'll always find, yes, but we needed this. This is, you know, this is what this can do.
Yeah, yeah. Like, okay.
Yeah. So, and we can all of us kind of find justifications for doing things. But actually, at the end of the day, is it the right thing at that moment in time? And does it actually sabotage us achieving our future aspirations, whatever those aspirations may be? And to be able to stop and think about this in a rational and logical way, do you know what? This is not going to help me achieve what I really want to achieve.
Yeah.
So I'll not buy this time. It is, like you say, it's the emotional regulation. It's
emotional
control.
Regulation. Yeah, it is. And I don't know if you've heard of, have you heard of boosters or boosting? It's basically, it's almost like the updated version of nudges. So we all know what nudges are, but boosting is effectively what we do. So it's where you, instead of kind of I say this lazily, tricking somebody to, you know, do whatever you want them to do, you know, the nudging.
Yes.
Instead, what we're doing here is helping that person develop the skills to make the better choice themselves,
yeah,
as opposed to being nudged. So it's a few of those things. Like I said, it's the coaching, it's the coaxing, it's the accountability, it's the understanding, the reflection piece. Like, and so many studies have found that that's actually much more impactful than a boost, which we know we're using in this world right now. But it makes all the difference.
Yeah. I think it's wonderful when you know that somebody has actually had a breakthrough in their journey. And, you know, it's going to make a real difference in their lives.
Oh, so, for sure.
And the thing is, you know, I just remember not that many years ago where some of the things that we've talked about, you know, people will be sort of rolling their eyes at, oh, yeah, that's that touchy-feely stuff. And actually, do you know what? This is the most powerful. Oftentimes people miss the biggest influencer in their finances, and it's them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, you know, and so we forget the person and we just look at the money.
Yeah.
And so, and that's, I suppose that's frustrated me a little bit about the financial well-being market. So even financiers, you know, whether they are investors or insurance or pensions, we're into financial well-being. We promote financial well-being. Oh, really? How do you do that? Well, we've got these products. And you're going, that's not financial well-being.
It's not.
And you actually allude to the fact, and I know Chris Budd talks about this as well, about the connection with money and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, just it's interesting. Peter Koenig wrote a book called The 30 Myths or The 30 Lies About Money.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that often comes up is this, you know, money will make me happy.
Yep.
And actually, money won't make you do anything because money is an inanimate object. You know, the person behind it is the individual making the choices and why they make the choices. So so when we talk about happiness, it may contribute to, but it can also detract from.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've come across those studies that show, I mean, they talk about £70,000, or was it $70? $70,000, I can't remember which, but that being the marker for, okay, this is the average level of what happiness would look like. And before that, you're really struggling with day-to-day living. So that's based on, you know, standard rates of living. But what we find from many studies of happiness generally across the board, so forget money, is you get something, you're happy, and then it plateaus.
Yeah.
And it goes back to normal levels. And then you get something, you're happy, and then it plateaus because it's dopamine, it's excitement, it's something new.
Yeah.
And actually, back to exactly what we're talking about, happiness is internal, not dictated by external things like food, clothes, cars, money or whatever.
Money.
Or money, yeah, if we just strip it back to the money. No, it's not about that. Or even a partner. You know, some people talk about finding a partner for them to be happy or bring them happiness. Actually, it's about you and how you view this stuff and what you believe you're capable of and all of that stuff. But no, these financial institutes or people are not talking from that angle, I guess, because that's not where the money is in terms of selling a product, right?
Yeah, yes.
That's that.
Yeah, it's all about how they frame the information they give out, you know, and like you said earlier on, you know, even these companies are using behavioral science to really understand their customer base and what motivates their customers so that they can frame how they communicate things to meet that sort of desire within the customer. And it's just, it's an interesting thing. I just want to, towards the back end now, but I just wanted to pick up on another aspect of finance, but not so much as an individual, but more in terms of small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been through a pandemic, and even now there's still the effects of it, but throughout that time and over these last few years, there's been a lot of sort of trying to help businesses out. But there's been that cohort of businesses who have always seemed to have fallen through the net, usually SMEs, small to medium-sized businesses that has fallen through the net because they've not met a particular criteria. Now, I know that you've spent time in the Houses of Parliament, House of Lords, talking about some of these things. What kind of things have you come across with regards to the whole sort of funding of businesses? And what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. And so you're referring to that most recent meeting, yeah, where we were trying to understand the challenges that SMEs were facing. And one area, so I asked, like I said, my community who are business owners, what areas are a real challenge for you right now? And the majority spoke about funding. They spoke about funding exactly as you said. A few people did also mention that some funding pots that are available are not available to them, whether it's because they don't earn enough or the amount of paperwork and administrative requirements for them to go ahead for that application just creates a massive barrier. So then it kind of goes against, okay, this funding's there to help organizations, but then there's so many restrictions that stop people from being able to access the funds. As some of the big areas that popped up.
Yeah, I think one of the, I mean, my own personal experience was, I remember there was one funding stream that came up that my business could actually partake in.
Yeah.
And so looking at, it wasn't huge amounts, it was only small amounts, but the amount of bureaucracy that you had to go through and the amount of analysis and data and so on that you had to provide. And you're thinking, this is actually the time spent in preparing would be more than what I'd actually get from it. It just seemed disproportionate.
Wild. That,
yeah, and there doesn't seem to be a balance. And I know that so many small businesses just probably felt the same way and fell through the cracks.
And one of the things I spoke about, it was the invite to 10 Downing Street. And one of the points I made, and there was another lady who was like, yes. Also, like exactly what you're saying, what's expected of that small business in terms of providing information?
Yeah.
A lot of those founders don't actually have the skills to pull together those reports. And I made the point that, okay, it's great that the fund is being provided, but actually the expertise that is needed to actually pull together some of this data, especially if it's a financial report, and if they're in the early stages of their business, they maybe haven't had that session with someone professional, or maybe they haven't got the funds to do that. So it's, you know, is there a way to strip back the wording or the format, or, you know, make it easier for someone to share that information without having to put it in really rigid, structures, formats? And that I've seen has been a massive barrier to a lot of people who are applying for funding. Want to help with that piece.
I know there's been a lot of issues, particularly from the COVID times, with regards to the funding that was available to businesses and people, certain things being relaxed and people applying for it, but actually not using it for the right reasons, or, just fraudulent activities. Yeah. So there is the issue that you have to balance between both, what you provide and accountability.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate that. But that's been a challenging thing for a lot of businesses. And it's just, there's that hope. And it was great that you were invited to along to number 10 to discuss these things. And thank you so much for asking your community as well, because oftentimes you can feel like a sort of a little fish in a big sea. And you're thinking to yourself, well, what difference can I make? But actually, collectively, and somebody like yourself, in a meeting where you're taking that collective response to what is quite, a key sort of issue for businesses, is a great encouragement. So thank you for doing that. When you went to number 10, I've been there myself. So when you walked through the door, had you been to number 10 before?
I must correct. So I was invited to number 10, and the night before it was changed to a different
Oh.
building. So I haven't been
Oh.
to the actual door number 10. So I didn't get
Oh no. Well.
the picture, and I plan to dress up for it and everything.
Oh dear. Oh, I'm sorry about that. But I was going to ask you about 'cause I ask people whenever they've been invited along and they go through that front door,
Yeah.
what was your expectation? And then how did you feel when you got in that first room? And it's interesting because it's not what you expect. I can tell you that now, having been there myself.
Well, I believe there'll be another time. So next time we'll do another podcast and I'll tell you.
Yeah, we'll have a good chat about it. Crystal, it's been wonderful talking to you. I'm aware time has passed us by now, and so I just want to say thank you so much. Just remind us all again, if anybody wants to talk to you and talk to you about Mind Over Money or your podcast or anything that you're actually doing, how could they get hold of you?
Yeah, thank you for that time. So yeah, Mind Over Money, the website is wearemindovermoney.com, or you can find my personal website, which is crystalmcgilvery.com. And I also exist on every social media platform. I exist doesn't mean I'm an ace at all of them, but I'm everywhere. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's either, get in touch for my work with corporates, delivering those programs, or, I work with like local councils and incubator programs to support business owners. Obviously on the financial side. And yeah, of course, working with people on a one-on-one basis. Some of those offerings are free because they're funded by the council, etc.
Yeah.
And some of them you have to pay for.
Wonderful. Well, Crystal, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you again. And I wish you all the best going forward. And maybe you never know, when you get to number 10, we'll have that conversation.
Yes, we will. It's gonna happen, definitely.
Yes. Well, you
Thank
take
you.
care. Thank you very much.
Thank you.